gardener, eat dormice? I have read so in Petronius, said the count. Really? They can't be nice, though they do say as fat as a dormouse. It is not a wonder they are fat, sleeping all day and only waking to eat all night. Listen, last year I had 4 apricots. They stole 1. I had 1 nectarine, only 1. Well, sir, they ate half of it on the wall. A splendid nectarine. I never ate a better.
You ate it?
That is to say, the half that was left, you understand.
It was exquisite, sir.
Ah, those gentlemen never choose the worst morsels, like Mayor Simon's son, who has not chosen the worst strawberries. But this year, continued the horticulturist, I'll take care it shall not happen, even if I should be forced to sit up the whole night to watch when the strawberries are ripe.
Monte Cristo had seen enough. Every man has a devouring passion in his heart, as every fruit has its worm. That of the man at the telegraph was horticulture. He began gathering the vine leaves which screened the sun from the grapes and won the heart of the gardener.
"Did you come here, sir, to see the telegraph?" he said.
"Yes, if it be not contrary to the rules."
"Oh, no," said the gardener. "There are no orders against doing so, provided there is nothing dangerous and that no one knows what we are saying."
"I have been told," said the count, "that you do not always yourselves understand the signals you repeat."
"Certainly, sir, and that is what I like best," said the man, smiling.
"Why do you like that best?"
"Because then I have no responsibility. I am a machine then and nothing else, and so long as I work, nothing more is required of me."
"Is it possible," said Monte Cristo to himself, "that I can have met with a man that has no ambition? That would spoil my plans."
"Sir," said the gardener, glancing at the sundial, "the 10 minutes are nearly expired. I must return to my post. Will you go up with me?"
"I follow you." Monte Cristo entered the tower, which was divided into 3 stages. The lowest contained gardening implements such as spades, rakes, watering pots, hung against the wall. This was all the furniture. The second was the usual dwelling, or rather sleeping place, of the man. It contained a few poor articles of household furniture, a bed, a table, 2 chairs, a stone pitcher, and some dry herbs hung up to the ceiling, which the count recognized as sweet peas, and of which the good man was preserving the seeds, having labeled them with as much care as if he had been master botanist in the Jardin des Plantes.
"Does it require much study to learn the art of telegraphing, sir?" asked Monte Cristo.
"The study does not take long. It was acting as a supernumerary that was so tedious."
"And what is the pay?"
1,000 francs, sir."
"It is nothing."
"No, but then we are lodged, as you perceive."
Monte Cristo looked at the room. They passed on to the 3rd stage. It was the room of the telegraph. Monte Cristo looked in turns at the 2 iron handles by which the machine was worked.
"It is very interesting," he said, "but it must be very tedious for a lifetime."
"Yes. At first my neck was cramped with looking at it, but at the end of a year I became used to it, and then we have our hours of recreation and our holidays."
"Holidays?"
"Yes."
"When?"
"When we have a fog."
"Ah, to be sure.
Those are, indeed, holidays to me. I go into the garden. I plant, I prune, I trim. I kill the insects all day long."
"How long have you been here?"
10 years, and 5 as a supernumerary make 15.
"You are
55 years old."
"How long must you have served to claim the pension?"
"Oh, sir, 25 years.
"And how much is the pension?"
100 crowns.
"Poor humanity," murmured Monte Cristo.
"What did you say, sir?"
asked the man. "I was saying it was very interesting."
"What was?"
"All you were showing me."
and you really understand none of these signals?
None at all.
And have you never tried to understand them?
Never.
Why should I? But still, there are some signals only addressed to you.
Certainly.
And do you understand them?
They are always the same.
And then mean
nothing new, you have an hour, or tomorrow.
This is simple enough, said the Count. But look, is not your correspondent putting itself in motion?
Ah, yes. Thank you, sir.
And what is it saying? Anything you understand?
Yes. It asks if I am ready.
And you reply, by the same sign, which, at the same time, tells my right-hand correspondent that I am ready, while it gives notice to my left-hand correspondent to prepare in his turn.
It is very ingenious, said the Count.
You will see, said the man proudly.
In 5 minutes, he will speak.
I have then 5 minutes, said Monte Cristo to himself. It is more time than I require. My dear sir, will you allow me to ask you a question?
What is it, sir?
You are fond of gardening?
Passionately.
And you would be pleased to have, instead of this terrace of 20 feet, an enclosure of 2 acres?
Sir, I should make a terrestrial paradise of it.
You live badly on your 1,000 francs.
Badly enough. But yet I do live.
Yes, but you have only a wretched garden.
True, the garden is not large.
And then, such as it is filled with dormice who eat everything.
Ah, they are my scourges.
Tell me, should you have the misfortune to turn your head while your right-hand correspondent was telegraphing,
I should not see him.
Then what would happen?
I could not repeat the signals.
And then,
not having repeated them through negligence, I should be fined.
How much?
100 francs.
The tenth of your income. That would be fine work.
Ah, said the man.
Has it ever happened to you? Said Monte Cristo.
Once, sir, when I was grafting a rose tree.
Well, suppose you were to alter a signal and substitute another.
Ah, that is another case. I should be turned off and lose my pension.
300 francs.
100 crowns, yes, sir. So you see that I am not likely to do any of these things.
Not even for 15 years' wages?
Come, it is worth thinking about. For 15,000 francs?
Yes.
Sir, you alarm me.
Nonsense.
Sir, you are tempting me.
Just so. 15,000 francs. Do you understand?
Sir, let me see my right-hand correspondent.
On the contrary, do not look at him, but on this.
What is it?
What? Do you not know these little papers?
Banknotes.
Exactly. There are 15 of them.
And whose are they?
Yours, if you like.
Mine?
Exclaimed the man, half suffocated. Yes, yours. Your own property.
Sir, my right-hand correspondent is signalling.
Let him.
Sir, you have distracted me. I shall be fined.
That will cost you 100 francs. You see, it is your interest to take my banknotes.
Sir, my right-hand correspondent redoubles. He signals he is impatient.
Never mind. Take these. And the Count placed the packet in the hands of the man. Now, this is not all, he said. You cannot live upon your 15,000 francs.
I shall still have my place.
No, you will lose it, for you are going to alter the sign of your correspondent.
Oh, sir, what are you proposing?
A jest.
Sir, unless you force me, I think I can effectually force you.
And Monte Cristo drew another packet from his pocket. Here are 10,000 more francs, he said. With the 15,000 already in your pocket, they will make 25,000. With 5,000, you can buy a pretty little house with 2 acres of land. The remaining 20,000 will bring you in 1,000 francs a year.
A garden?
with 2 acres of land and 1,000 francs a year. Oh, heavens! Come, take them. And Monte Cristo forced the banknotes into his hand. What am I to do? Nothing very difficult, but what is it? To repeat these signs. Monte Cristo took a paper from his pocket, upon which were drawn 3 signs, with numbers to indicate the order in which they were to be worked. There, you see. It will not take long. Yes, but do this, and you will have nectarines and all the rest. The mark was hit. Red with fever, while the large drops fell from his brow, the man executed one after the other the 3 signs given by the count, notwithstanding the frightful contortions of the right-hand correspondent, who, not understanding the change, began to think the gardener had become mad. As to the left-hand one, he conscientiously repeated the same signals, which were definitely carried to the Minister of the Interior. "Now, you are rich," said Monte Cristo. "Yes," replied the man. "But at what a price?" "Listen, friend," said Monte Cristo. "I do not wish to cause you any remorse. Believe me, then, when I swear to you that you have wronged no man, but on the contrary, have benefited mankind." The man looked at the banknotes, felt them, counted them. He turned pale, then red, then rushed into his room to drink a glass of water, but he had not time to reach the water jug and fainted in the midst of his dried herbs. 5 minutes after, the new telegraph reached the minister. Debray had the horses put to his carriage and drove to Dangla.
"Has your husband any Spanish bonds?" he asked of the baroness. "I think so, indeed. He has 6 millions worth. He must sell them at whatever price." "Why?" "Because Don Carlos has fled from Bourges and has returned to Spain." "How do you know?" Debray shrugged his shoulders. "The idea of asking how I hear the news," he said.
The baroness did not wait for a repetition. She ran to her husband, who immediately hastened to his agent and ordered him to sell at any price. When it was seen that Dangla sold, the Spanish funds fell directly. Dangla lost 500,000 francs, but he rid himself of all his Spanish shares. The same evening, the following was read in Le Messager. Telegraphic dispatch. The King, Don Carlos, has escaped the vigilance exercised over him at Bourges and has returned to Spain by the Catalonian frontier. Barcelona has risen in his favor. All that evening, nothing was spoken of but the foresight of Dangla, who had sold his shares, and of the luck of the stockjobber, who only lost 500,000 francs by such a blow. Those who had kept their shares, or bought those of Dangla, looked upon themselves as ruined, and passed a very bad night. The next morning, Le Moniteur contained the following. It was without any foundation that Le Messager yesterday announced the flight of Don Carlos and the revolt of Barcelona. The King, Don Carlos, has not left Bourges, and the peninsula is in the enjoyment of profound peace. A telegraphic signal, improperly intercepted owing to the fog, was the cause of this error. The funds rose 1% higher than before they had fallen. This, reckoning his loss and what he had missed gaining, made the difference of 1 million to Dangla. "Good," said Monte Cristo to Morel, who was at his house when the news arrived of the strange reverse of fortune of which Dangla had been the victim. "I have just made a discovery for 25,000 francs, for which I would have paid 100,000. "What have you discovered?" asked Morel. "I have just discovered the method of ridding a gardener of the dormice that eat his peaches." 63. Shadows. At first sight, the exterior of the house at Auteuil presented nothing splendid, nothing one would expect from the destined residence of the magnificent Count of Monte Cristo. But this simplicity was but according to the will of its master, who positively ordered nothing to be altered outside. This was seen by examining the interior. Indeed, scarcely could the door be opened before the scene changed.
Monsieur Bertuccio had outdone himself in the taste displayed in furnishing and in the rapidity with which it was executed. As formerly the Duc d'Antin had in a single night caused a whole avenue of trees to be cut down that annoyed Louis XIV, so in 3 days had Monsieur Bertuccio planted an entirely bare court with poplars, large spreading sycamore shading the different parts of the house, before which, instead of the usual paving stones half hidden by the grass, there extended a turf lawn but that morning laid down, and upon which the water was yet glistening. For the rest, the orders had been issued by the Count. He himself had given a plan to Bertuccio, marking the spot where each tree was to be planted, and the shape and extent of the lawn, which was to succeed the paving stones. Thus, the house had become unrecognizable, and Bertuccio himself declared he scarcely knew it, encircled as it was by a framework of trees. The overseer would not have objected, while he was about it, to have made some improvements in the garden, but the Count had positively forbidden it to be touched. Bertuccio made amends, however, by loading the antechambers, staircases, and chimneys with flowers, that which, above all, manifested the shrewdness of the steward and the profound science of the master, the one in carrying out the ideas of the other, was that this house, which appeared only the night before so sad and gloomy, impregnated with that sickly smell one can almost fancy to be the smell of time, had, in one day, acquired the aspect of life, was scented with its master's favourite perfumes, and had the very light regulated according to his wish. When the Count arrived, he had under his touch his books and arms. His eyes rested upon his favourite pictures. His dogs, whose caresses he loved, welcomed him in the antechamber. The birds, whose songs delighted him, cheered him with their music. And the house, awakened from its long sleep like the sleeping beauty in the wood, lived, sang, and bloomed like the houses we have cherished, and in which, when we are forced to leave them, we leave a part of our souls. The servants passed gaily along the fine courtyard, some belonging to the kitchens, gliding down the stairs, restored but the previous day, as if they had always inhabited the house, others filling the coach-houses, where the equipages, encased and numbered, appeared to have been installed for the last 50 years, and in the stables the horses replied by neighing to the grooms, who spoke to them with much more respect than many servants pay their masters. The library was divided into two parts on either side of the wall, and contained upwards of 2,000 volumes. One division was entirely devoted to novels, and even the one which had been published but the day before was to be seen in its place in all the dignity of its red and gold binding. On the other side of the house, to match with the library, was the conservatory, ornamented with rare flowers blossoming in china jars. And in the midst of the greenhouse, marvellous alike to sight and smell, was a billiard table, apparently abandoned during the last hour by the players who had left the balls on the cloth. One chamber alone had been respected by the magnificent Bertuccio. Before this room, to which you could ascend by the grand and go out by the back staircase, the servants passed with curiosity, and Bertuccio with terror. At 5 o'clock precisely, the Count arrived before the house at Auteuil, followed by Ali. Bertuccio was awaiting this arrival with impatience mingled with uneasiness. He hoped for some compliments, while at the same time he feared to have frowns. Monte Cristo descended in the courtyard, walked all over the house without giving any sign of approbation or displeasure, until he entered his bedroom, situated on the opposite side of the closed room. Then he approached a little piece of furniture made of rosewood, which we remember to have noticed on a previous occasion. "That will at least serve to put my gloves in," he said. "Will Your Excellency deign to open it?" said the delighted Bertuccio. "And you will find gloves in it." In all the rest of the furniture, the Count found everything he required, smelling bottles, cigars, bijouterie. "Good," he said, and Monsieur Bertuccio left enraptured. So great, so powerful, and so real was the influence exercised by this man over all who surrounded him. At precisely 6 o'clock, the clatter of horses' hoofs was heard at the entrance door. It was our captain of Spahi, who had arrived on Medea.
I am sure I am the first," cried Morel. "I did it on purpose to have you a minute to myself before everyone came. Julie and Emmanuel have a thousand things to tell you. Ah, really, this is magnificent. But tell me, Count, will your people take care of my horse? Do not alarm yourself, my dear Maximilian. They understand. I mean, because he wants petting. If you had seen at what a pace he came, like the wind, I should think so. A horse that cost 5,000 francs, said Monte Cristo, in the tone which a father would use towards a son.
Do you regret them? Asked Morel, with his open laugh.
I? Certainly not, replied the Count. No, I should only regret if the horse had not proved good. It is so good that I have distanced Monsieur de Chateau Renaud, one of the best riders in France, and Monsieur de Bray, who both mount the minister's Arabians, and close at their heels are the horses of Madame Danglars, who always go at 6 leagues an hour.
Then they follow you? Asked Monte Cristo.
See, they are here. And at the same minute, a carriage with smoking horses, accompanied by 2 mounted gentlemen, arrived at the gate which opened before them. The carriage drove round and stopped at the steps, followed by the horsemen. The instant Debray had touched the ground, he was at the carriage door. He offered his hand to the Baroness, who, descending, took it with a peculiarity of manner imperceptible to everyone but Monte Cristo. But nothing escaped the Count's notice, and he observed a little note slipped with an indescribable ease, bespeaking the frequent practice of this manoeuvre, from the hand of Madame Danglars to that of the minister's secretary. After his wife, the banker descended, pale as though he had issued from the tomb instead of his carriage. Madame Danglars threw a rapid and inquiring glance around, which could only be interpreted by Monte Cristo, embracing the courtyard, the peristyle, and the front of the house. Then, repressing a slight emotion which must have been seen on her countenance if she had permitted her face to become pale, she ascended the steps, saying to Morel,
"Sir, if you were a friend of mine, I should ask you if you would sell your horse."
Morel smiled with an expression very like a grimace, and then turned round to Monte Cristo as if to ask him to extricate him from his embarrassments. The Count understood him.
"Ah, madame," he said, "why did you not make that request of me?"
"With you, sir," replied the Baroness, "one can wish for nothing, one is so sure to obtain it. If it were so with Monsieur Morel..."
"Unfortunately," replied the Count, "I am witness that Monsieur Morel cannot give up his horse, his honour being engaged in keeping it."
"How so?"
"He laid a wager he would tame Medea in the space of 6 months. You understand now that if he were to get rid of it before the time named, he would not only lose his bet, but people would say he was afraid of it, and a brave captain of Spahi cannot risk this even to gratify a pretty woman, which is, in my opinion, one of the most sacred obligations in the world."
"You see my position, madame," said Morel, bestowing a grateful smile on Monte Cristo. "It seems to me," said Danglars, in his coarse tone, ill-concealed by a forced smile, "that you have already got horses enough."
Madame Danglars seldom allowed remarks of this kind to pass unnoticed, but, to the surprise of the young people, she pretended not to hear it and said nothing. Monte Cristo smiled at her unusual humility and showed her 2 immense porcelain jars covered with marine plants of a size and delicacy that could alone emanate from nature. The Baroness was astonished.
"Why," said she, "you could plant one of the chestnut trees in the Tuileries inside. How can such enormous jars have been manufactured?"
"Ah, madame," replied Monte Cristo, "you must not ask of us, the manufacturers of glass muslin, such a question. It is the work of another age, constructed by the genii of earth and water."
"How so? At what period can that have been?"
"I do not know. I have only heard that an emperor of China had an oven built expressly, and that in this oven 12 jars like this were successively baked. 2 broke from the heat of the fire, the other 10 were sunk 300 fathoms deep into the sea.
The sea, knowing what was required of her, threw over them her weeds, encircled them with coral, and encrusted them with shells. The whole was cemented by 200 years beneath these almost impervious depths, for a revolution carried away the emperor who wished to make the trial, and only left the documents proving the manufacture of the jars and their descent into the sea. At the end of 200 years, the documents were found, and they thought of bringing up the jars. Divers descended in machines made expressly on the discovery into the bay where they were thrown. But of 10, 3 only remained, the rest having been broken by the waves. I am fond of these jars, upon which perhaps misshapen, frightful monsters have fixed their cold, dull eyes, and in which myriads of small fish have slept, seeking a refuge from the pursuit of their enemies. Meanwhile, Danglar, who had cared little for curiosities, was mechanically tearing off the blossoms of a splendid orange tree one after another. When he had finished with the orange tree, he began at the cactus, but this not being so easily plucked as the orange tree pricked him dreadfully. He shuddered and rubbed his eyes as though awaking from a dream. "Sir," said Monte Cristo to him, "I do not recommend my pictures to you, who possess such splendid paintings, but nevertheless, here are 2 by Hobbima, a Paul Potter, a Meurice, 2 Gerard Dow, a Raphael, a Van Dyck, a Zubaran, and 2 or 3 by Murillo, worth looking at."
"Stay," said Debray. "I recognize this Hobbima."
"Ah, indeed."
"Yes. It was proposed for the museum."
"Which, I believe, does not contain one," said Monte Cristo.
"No, and yet they refuse to buy it."
"Why?" said Chateau Renaud.
"You pretend not to know? Because government was not rich enough."
"Ah, pardon me," said Chateau Renaud. "I have heard of these things every day during the last 8 years, and I cannot understand them yet."
"You will, by and by," said Debray.
"I think not," replied Chateau Renaud. Major Bartolomeo Cavalcanti and Count Andrea Cavalcanti, announced Battistan. A black satin stock, fresh from the maker's hands, grey moustaches, a bold eye, a major's uniform, ornamented with 3 medals and 5 crosses, in fact, the thorough bearing of an old soldier, such was the appearance of Major Bartolomeo Cavalcanti, that tender father with whom we are already acquainted. Close to him, dressed in entirely new clothes, advanced smilingly Count Andrea Cavalcanti, the dutiful son, whom we also know. The 3 young people were talking together. On the entrance of the newcomers, their eyes glanced from father to son, and then, naturally enough, rested on the latter, whom they began criticizing.
"Cavalcanti," said Debray.
"A fine name," said Morel. "Yes," said Chateau Renaud. "These Italians are well named and badly dressed."
"You are fastidious, Chateau Renaud," replied Debray. "Those clothes are well cut and quite new."
"That is just what I find fault with. That gentleman appears to be well dressed for the first time in his life."
"Who are those gentlemen?" asked Danglars of Monte Cristo.
"You heard. Cavalcanti."
"That tells me their name and nothing else."
"Ah, true. You do not know the Italian nobility. The Cavalcanti are all descended from princes."
"Have they any fortune?"
"An enormous one." "What do they do?" "Try to spend it all." "They have some business with you, I think, from what they told me the day before yesterday. I indeed invited them here today on your account. I will introduce you to them."
"But they appear to speak French with a very pure accent," said Danglars.
"The son has been educated in a college in the south, I believe, near Marseille. You will find him quite enthusiastic."
"Upon what subject?" asked Madame Danglars.
"The French ladies, madame. He has made up his mind to take a wife from Paris."
"A fine idea, that of his," said Danglars, shrugging his shoulders.
Madame Danglars looked at her husband with an expression which at any other time would have indicated a storm, but for the second time she controlled herself.
"The Baron appears thoughtful today," said Monte Cristo to her. "Are they going to put him in the ministry?"
"Not yet, I think. More likely, he has been speculating on the bourse and has lost money."
"Monsieur and Madame de Villefort," cried Baptista. They entered. Monsieur de Villefort, notwithstanding his self-control, was visibly affected, and when Monte Cristo touched his hand, he felt it tremble.
"Certainly, women alone know how to dissimulate," said Monte Cristo to himself, glancing at Madame Danglars, who was smiling on the Procureur du Roi and embracing his wife. After a short time, the Count saw Bertuccio, who until then had been occupied on the other side of the house, glide into an adjoining room. He went to him.
"What do you want, Monsieur Bertuccio?" said he. "Your Excellency has not stated the number of guests."
"Ah, true. How many covers?"
"Count for yourself."
"Is everyone here, Your Excellency?"
"Yes." Bertuccio glanced through the door, which was ajar. The Count watched him.
"Good heavens!" he exclaimed.
"What is the matter?" said the Count.
That woman!
"Which?"
"The one with a white dress and so many diamonds. The fair one."
"Madame Danglars?
I do not know her name, but it is she. Sir, it is she."
"Whom do you mean?"
"The woman of the garden. She that was enceinte. She who was walking while she waited for—"
Bertuccio stood at the open door, with his eyes starting and his hair on end.
"Waiting for whom?"
Bertuccio, without answering, pointed to Villefort with something of the gesture Macbeth uses to point out Banquo.
"Oh, oh," he at length muttered. "Do you see?"
"What? Who?"
"Him."
"Him? Monsieur de Villefort, the Procureur du Roi?"
"Certainly I see him." "Then I did not kill him."
"Really, I think you are going mad, good Bertuccio," said the Count.
"Then he is not dead?"
"No. You see plainly he is not dead. Instead of striking between the sixth and seventh left rib, as your countrymen do, you must have struck higher or lower, and life is very tenacious in these lawyers. Or, rather, there is no truth in anything you have told me. It was a flight of the imagination, a dream of your fancy. You went to sleep full of thoughts of vengeance. They weighed heavily upon your stomach. You had the nightmare. That's all. Come, calm yourself and reckon. Monsieur and Madame de Villefort, 2. Monsieur and Madame Danglars, 4. Monsieur de Chateau Renaud, Monsieur de Bray, Monsieur Morel, 7. Major Bartolomeo Cavalcanti, 8. 8, repeated Bertuccio.
Stop! You are in a shocking hurry to be off. You forget one of my guests. Lean a little to the left. Stay, look at Monsieur Andrea Cavalcanti, that young man in a black coat looking at Murillo's Madonna. Now he is turning." This time Bertuccio would have uttered an exclamation had not a look from Monte Cristo silenced him.
"Benedetto," he muttered. "Fatality."
6:30 has just struck, Monsieur Bertuccio," said the Count severely. "I ordered dinner at that hour, and I do not like to wait." And he returned to his guests, while Bertuccio, leaning against the wall, succeeded in reaching the dining room. 5 minutes afterwards, the doors of the drawing room were thrown open, and Bertuccio, appearing, said with a violent effort, "The dinner waits." The Count of Monte Cristo offered his arm to Madame de Villefort. "Monsieur de Villefort," he said, "will you conduct the Baroness Danglars?" Villefort complied, and they passed on to the dining room. 64. The Dinner. It was evident that one sentiment pervaded the whole of the guests on entering the dining room. Each one asked himself what strange influence had conducted them to this house, and yet, astonished, even uneasy though they were, they still felt they would not like to be absent.
the recent events, the solitary and eccentric position of the Count, his enormous, nay, almost incredible fortune, should have made men cautious, and have altogether prevented ladies visiting a house where there was no one of their own sex to receive them. And yet both had passed the bounds of prudence and decorum. Stimulated by an invincible curiosity, there were none present, even including Cavalcanti and his son, notwithstanding the stiffness of the one and the carelessness of the other, who were not thoughtful on finding themselves assembled at the house of this incomprehensible man. Madame Danglars had started when Villefort, on the Count's invitation, offered his arm, and Villefort felt that his glance was uneasy beneath his gold spectacles when he felt the arm of the Baroness press upon his own. None of this had escaped the Count, and even by this mere contact of individuals, the scene had already acquired considerable interest for an observer. Monsieur de Villefort had on the right hand Madame Danglars, on his left Morel. The Count was seated between Madame de Villefort and Danglars. The other seats were filled by Debray, who was placed between the two Cavalcanti, and by Chateau Renaud, seated between Madame de Villefort and Morel. The repast was magnificent. Monte Cristo had endeavoured completely to overturn the Parisian ideas and to feed the curiosity as much as the appetite of his guests. It was an Oriental feast that he offered to them, but of such a kind as the Arabian fairies might be supposed to prepare. Every delicious fruit that the four quarters of the globe could provide was heaped in vases from China and jars from Japan. Rare birds retaining their most brilliant plumage, enormous fish spread upon massive silver dishes, together with every wine produced in the archipelago, Asia Minor, or the Cape, sparkling in bottles whose grotesque shape seemed to give an additional flavour to the wine. All these, like one of those displays with which Apicius of old gratified his guests, passed in review before the eyes of the astonished Parisians, who understood that it was possible to expend £1,000 upon a dinner for 10 persons, but only on the condition of eating pearls, like Cleopatra, or drinking beaten gold, like Lorenzo de' Medici. Monte Cristo noticed the general astonishment, and began laughing and joking about it. "Gentlemen," he said, "you will admit that when arrived at a certain degree of fortune, the superfluities of life are all that can be desired, and the ladies will allow that, after having risen to a certain eminence of position, the ideal alone can be more exalted. Now, to follow out this reasoning, what is the marvellous? That which we do not understand. What is it that we really desire? That which we cannot obtain. Now, to see things which I cannot understand, to procure impossibilities, these are the study of my life. I gratify my wishes by two means, my will and my money. I take as much interest in the pursuit of some whim as you do, Monsieur Danglars, in forming a new railway line, you, Monsieur de Villefort, in condemning a culprit to death, you, Monsieur Debray, in pacifying a kingdom, you, Monsieur de Chateau Renaud, in pleasing a woman, and you, Morel, in breaking a horse that no one can ride. For example, you see these two fish, one brought 50 leagues beyond St. Petersburg, the other 5 leagues from Naples. Is it not amusing to see them both on the same table? What are the two fish? Asked Danglars. Monsieur Chateau Renaud, who has lived in Russia, will tell you the name of one, and Major Cavalcanti, who is an Italian, will tell you the name of the other. This one is, I think, a sterlet, said Chateau Renaud, and that one, if I mistake not, a lamprey. Just so. Now, Monsieur Danglars, ask these gentlemen where they are caught. Sterlets, said Chateau Renaud, are only found in the Volga. And, said Cavalcanti, I know that Lake Fossaro alone supplies lampreys of that size. Exactly. One comes from the Volga, and the other from Lake Fossaro. Impossible, cried all the guests simultaneously. Well, this is just what amuses me, said Monte Cristo. I am like Nero, cupitor impossibilium, and that it is which is amusing you at this moment. This fish,
which seems so exquisite to you, is very likely no better than perch or salmon, but it seemed impossible to procure it, and here it is. But how could you have these fish brought to France? Oh, nothing more easy. Each fish was brought over in a cask, one filled with river herbs and weeds, the other with rushes and lake plants. They were placed in a wagon built on purpose, and thus the sterlet lived 12 days, the lamprey 8, and both were alive when my cook seized them, killing one with milk and the other with wine.
You do not believe me, Monsieur Danglars.
I cannot help doubting, answered Danglars, with his stupid smile.
But he's done, said the Count.
Have the other fish brought in, the sterlet and the lamprey which came in the other casks, and which are yet alive.
Danglars opened his bewildered eyes. The company clapped their hands. 4 servants carried in 2 casks, covered with aquatic plants, and in each of which was breathing a fish similar to those on the table.
But why have 2 of each sort? Asked Danglars.
Merely because one might have died, carelessly answered Monte Cristo.
You are certainly an extraordinary man, said Danglars, and philosophers may well say it is a fine thing to be rich, and to have ideas, added Madame Danglars.
Oh, do not give me credit for this, madame. It was done by the Romans, who much esteemed them, and Pliny relates that they sent slaves from Ostia to Rome, who carried on their heads fish which he calls the mulus, and which, from the description, must probably be the goldfish. It was also considered a luxury to have them alive, it being an amusing sight to see them die, for, when dying, they change colour 3 or 4 times and, like the rainbow, when it disappears, pass through all the prismatic shades, after which they were sent to the kitchen. Their agony formed part of their merit. If they were not seen alive, they were despised when dead.
Yes, said Debray, but then Ostia is only a few leagues from Rome.
True, said Monte Cristo, but what would be the use of living 1800 years after Lucullus, if we can do no better than he could?
The 2 Cavalcanti opened their enormous eyes, but had the good sense not to say anything.
All this is very extraordinary, said Chateau Renaud. Still, what I admire the most, I confess, is the marvellous promptitude with which your orders are executed. Is it not true that you only bought this house 5 or 6 days ago?
Certainly not longer.
Well, I am sure it is quite transformed since last week. If I remember rightly, it had another entrance, and the courtyard was paved and empty, while today we have a splendid lawn bordered by trees which appear to be 100 years old.
Why not? I am fond of grass and shade, said Monte Cristo.
Yes, said Madame de Villefort. The door was towards the road before, and on the day of my miraculous escape you brought me into the house from the road, I remember.
Yes, madame, said Monte Cristo, but I preferred having an entrance which would allow me to see the Bois de Boulogne over my gate.
In 4 days, said Morrel, it is extraordinary.
Indeed, said Chateau Renaud, it seems quite miraculous to make a new house out of an old one, for it was very old and dull, too.
I recollect coming for my mother to look at it when Monsieur de Saint-Marin advertised it for sale 2 or 3 years ago.
Monsieur de Saint-Marin, said Madame de Villefort. Then this house belonged to Monsieur de Saint-Marin before you bought it?
It appears so, replied Monte Cristo.
How? Do you not know of whom you purchased it?
No, indeed. My steward transacts all this business for me.
It is certainly 10 years since the house has been occupied, said Chateau Renaud, and it was quite melancholy to look at it, with the blinds closed, the doors locked, and the weeds in the court. Really, if the house had not belonged to the father-in-law of the Procureur du Roi, one might have thought it some accursed place where a horrible crime had been committed.
Villefort, who had hitherto not tasted the 3 or 4 glasses of rare wine which were placed before him, here took one,
and drank it off. Monte Cristo allowed a short time to elapse and then said, "It is singular, Baron, but the same idea came across me the first time I entered it. It looks so gloomy. I should never have bought it if my steward had not acted for me. Perhaps the fellow had been bribed by the notary." "It is probable," stammered out de Vifor. "But, believe me, I have nothing to do with this corruption. This house is part of the marriage portion of Valentine, and Monsieur de Saint Méran wished to sell it, for if it had remained another year or two uninhabited, it would have fallen to ruin."
It was Morel's turn to become pale. "There was, above all, one room," continued Monte Cristo, "very plain in appearance, hung with red damask, which, I know not why, appeared to me quite dramatic."
"Why so?" said Danglars. "Why dramatic?"
"Can we account for instinct?" said Monte Cristo. "Are there not some places where we seem to breathe sadness? Why, we cannot tell. It is a chain of recollections, an idea which carries you back to other times, to other places, which, very likely, have no connection with the present time and place. And there is something in this room which reminds me forcibly of the chamber of the Marchioness de Ganges, or Desdemona. Stay, since we have finished dinner, I will show it to you, and then we will take coffee in the garden. After dinner, the play." Monte Cristo looked inquiringly at his guests. Madame de Vifor rose, Monte Cristo did the same, and the rest followed their example. Vifor and Madame Danglars remained for a moment as if rooted to their seats. They interrogated each other with cold, glazed eyes.
"Did you hear?" said Madame Danglars.
"We must go," replied Vifor, offering his arm.
Everyone else was already scattered in different parts of the house, urged by curiosity, for they thought the visit would not be limited to the one room, and that, at the same time, they would obtain a view of the rest of the building, of which Monte Cristo had created a palace. Each one went out by the open doors. Monte Cristo waited for the two who remained. Then, when they had passed, he closed the march with a smile, which, if they could have understood it, would have alarmed them much more than a visit to the room they were about to enter. They, therefore, began by walking through the apartments, many of which were fitted up in the Eastern style, with cushions and divans instead of beds, and pipes instead of furniture. The drawing-rooms were decorated with the rarest pictures by the old masters, the boudoirs hung with draperies from China, of fanciful colours, fantastic design, and wonderful texture. At length they arrived at the famous room. There was nothing particular about it, excepting that, although daylight had disappeared, it was not lighted, and everything in it remained antique, while the rest of the rooms had been redecorated. These two causes were enough to give it a gloomy tinge.
"Oh," cried Madame de Vifor, "it is really frightful."
Madame Danglars tried to utter a few words, but was not heard. Many observations were made, the result of which was the unanimous opinion that there was a sinister appearance in the room.
"Is it not so?"
asked Monte Cristo.
"Look at that large, clumsy bed, hung with such gloomy, blood-coloured drapery. And those two crayon portraits that have faded from the damp, do they not seem to say, with their pale lips and staring eyes, 'We have seen'?"
Vifor became livid. Madame Danglars fell into a long seat placed near the chimney.
"Oh," said Madame de Vifor, smiling, "are you courageous enough to sit down upon the very seat, perhaps upon which the crime was committed?"
Madame Danglars rose suddenly.
"And then," said Monte Cristo, "this is not all."
"What is there more?" said Debray, who had not failed to notice the agitation of Madame Danglars. "Ah, what else is there?" said Danglars. "For at present I cannot say that I have seen anything extraordinary. What do you say, Monsieur Cavalcante?" "Ah," said he, "we have at Pisa the Tower of Ugolino, at Ferrara the prison of Tasso, at Rimini the room of Francesca and Paolo."
"Yes, but you have not this little staircase," said Monte Cristo, opening a door concealed by the drapery. "Look at it.
and tell me what you think of it." "What a wicked-looking, crooked staircase," said Chateau Renaud, smiling.
"I do not know whether the wine of Chios produces melancholy, but certainly everything appears to me black in this house," said Debray.
Ever since Valentine's diary had been mentioned, Morel had been silent and sad. "Can you not imagine," said Monte Cristo, "some Othello or Abbé de Ganges, one stormy, dark night, descending these stairs step by step, carrying a heavy load, which he wishes to hide from the sight of man, if not from God?" Madame Danglars half fainted on the arm of Villefort, who was obliged to support himself against the wall.
"Ah, madame," cried Debray, "what is the matter with you? How pale you look!" "This is what is the matter with her," said Madame de Villefort. "It is very simple. Monsieur de Monte Cristo is relating horrible stories to us, doubtless intending to frighten us to death."
"Yes," said Villefort. "Really, Count, you frighten the ladies."
"What is the matter?" asked Debray in a whisper of Madame Danglars. "Nothing," she replied with a violent effort. "I want air, that is all." "Will you come into the garden?" said Debray, advancing towards the back staircase. "No, no," she answered. "I would rather remain here."
"Are you really frightened, madame?" said Monte Cristo.
"Oh, no, sir," said Madame Danglars. "But you suppose scenes in a manner which gives them the appearance of reality."
"Ah, yes," said Monte Cristo, smiling. "It is all a matter of the imagination. Why should we not imagine this the apartment of an honest family woman, and this bed with red hangings a bed visited by the goddess Lucina, and that mysterious staircase, the passage through which, not to disturb their sleep, the doctor and nurse pass, or even the father carrying the sleeping child?" Here Madame Danglars, instead of being calmed by this soft picture, uttered a groan and fainted.
"Madame Danglars is ill," said Villefort. "It would be better to take her to her carriage."
"Oh, and I have forgotten my smelling bottle," said Monte Cristo.
"I have mine," said Madame de Villefort, and she passed over to Monte Cristo a bottle full of the same kind of red liquid whose good properties the Count had tested on Edouard.
"Ah," said Monte Cristo, taking it from her hand.
"Yes," she said, "at your advice I have tried."
"And have you succeeded?"
"I think so."
Madame Danglars was carried into the adjoining room. Monte Cristo dropped a very small portion of the red liquid upon her lips. She returned to consciousness.
"Ah," she cried, "what a frightful dream."
Villefort pressed her hand to let her know it was not a dream. Monsieur Danglars was sought, but, little interested in poetical ideas, he had gone into the garden and was talking with Major Cavalcanti on the projected railway from Leghorn to Florence. Monte Cristo seemed in despair. He took the arm of Madame Danglars and conducted her into the garden, where they found Danglars taking coffee between the Cavalcanti.
"Really, madame," he said, "did I alarm you much?"
"Oh, no, sir," she answered. "But, you know, things impress us differently according to the mood of our minds." Villefort forced a laugh.
"And then, you know," he said, "an idea, a supposition, is sufficient."
"Well," said Monte Cristo, "you may believe me if you like, but it is my belief that a crime has been committed in this house."
"Take care," said Madame de Villefort. "The Procureur du Roi is here."
"Ah," replied Monte Cristo, "since that is the case, I will take advantage of his presence to make my declaration."
"Your declaration?" said Villefort.
"Yes, before witnesses."
"Oh, this is very interesting," said Debray. "If there really has been a crime, we will investigate it."
"There has been a crime," said Monte Cristo. "Come this way, gentlemen. Come, Monsieur Villefort, for a declaration to be available should be made before the competent authorities." He then took Villefort's arm, and at the same time, holding that of Madame Danglars under his own, he dragged the procureur to the plantain tree, where the shade was thickest. All the other guests followed. "Stay," said Monte Cristo, "here, in this very spot," and he stamped upon the ground. "I had the earth dug up and fresh mould put in to refresh these old trees. Well, my man, digging, found a box, or rather the ironwork of a box, in the midst of which was the skeleton of a newly born infant." Monte Cristo felt the arm of Madame Danglars stiffen while that of Villefort trembled.
"A newly born infant?" repeated Debray. "This affair becomes serious."
"Well," said Château Renaud, "I was not wrong just now, then, when I said that houses had souls and faces like men, and that their exteriors carried the impress of their characters. This house was gloomy because it was remorseful. It was remorseful because it concealed a crime."
"Who said it was a crime?" asked Villefort, with a last effort.
"How? Is it not a crime to bury a living child in a garden?" cried Monte Cristo. "And pray, what do you call such an action?"
"But who said it was buried alive?"
"Why bury it there if it were dead? This garden has never been a cemetery."
"What is done to infanticides in this country?" asked Major Cavalcanti innocently. "Oh, their heads are soon cut off," said Danglars. "Ah, indeed," said Cavalcanti.
"I think so. Am I not right, Monsieur de Villefort?" asked Monte Cristo.
"Yes, Count," replied de Villefort, in a voice now scarcely human.
Monte Cristo saw that the two persons for whom he had prepared this scene could scarcely bear it, so, not wishing to carry it too far, he said, "Come, gentlemen, some coffee. We seem to have forgotten it." And he conducted the guests back to the table on the lawn.
"Indeed, Count," said Madame Danglars, "I am ashamed to own it, but all your frightful stories have so upset me that I must beg you to let me sit down."
And she fell into a chair. Monte Cristo bowed and went to Madame de Villefort. "I think Madame Danglars again requires your bottle," he said. But before Madame de Villefort could reach her friend, the procureur had found time to whisper to Madame Danglars,
"I must speak to you."
"When?"
"Tomorrow."
"Where?"
"In my office, or in the court, if you like. That is the surest place."
"I will go."
At this moment, Madame de Villefort approached.
"Thanks, my dear friend," said Madame Danglars, trying to smile. "It is over now, and I am much better."
65. The Beggar. The evening passed on. Madame de Villefort expressed a desire to return to Paris, which Madame Danglars had not dared to do, notwithstanding the uneasiness she experienced. On his wife's request, Monsieur de Villefort was the first to give the signal of departure. He offered a seat in his landau to Madame Danglars, that she might be under the care of his wife. As for Monsieur Danglars, absorbed in an interesting conversation with Monsieur Cavalcanti, he paid no attention to anything that was passing. While Monte Cristo had begged the smelling bottle of Madame de Villefort, he had remarked the approach of Villefort to Madame Danglars, and he soon guessed all that had passed between them, though the words had been uttered in so low a voice as hardly to be heard by Madame Danglars. Without opposing their arrangements, he allowed Morel, Château Renaud, and Debray to leave on horseback, and the ladies in Monsieur de Villefort's carriage. Danglars, more and more delighted with Major Cavalcanti, had offered him a seat in his carriage. Andrea Cavalcanti found his tilbury waiting at the door. The groom, in every respect a caricature of the English fashion, was standing on tiptoes to hold a large iron-grey horse. Andrea had spoken very little during dinner. He was an intelligent lad, and he feared to utter some absurdity before so many grand people, amongst whom he saw with dilating eyes the Procureur du Roi. Then he had been seized upon by Danglars, who, taking a rapid glance at the stiff-necked old major and his modest son, and taking into consideration the hospitality of the Count, made up his mind that he was in the society of some nabob, come to Paris to finish the worldly education of his only son. He contemplated with unspeakable delight the large diamond which shone on the Major's little finger, for the Major, like a prudent man, in case of any accident happening to his banknotes, had immediately converted them into articles of value. Then, after dinner, on the pretext of business, he questioned the father and son upon their mode of living, and the father and son, previously informed that it was through Dangla the one was to receive his 48,000 francs and the other 50,000 livres annually, they were so